is, first of all, from council. And it looks like both council are here. Is that correct?
Yes.
Great.
Yes,
and are there, excellent. Is there anyone here who council was expecting to join who has been unable to or is not on?
Not from the respondent.
No, Your Honor.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Welcome to Minnesota Court of Appeals. I'm Judge Tracy Smith, Judge Wheelock, Judge Gaetis, also on our panel. We apologize for the delay in getting started this morning. We had some administrative issues. Thank you for your patience. I'm very sorry about that. Today's case is, the case before us right now is A23-0292, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Zachary Philip Harding Appellant. Council, we are on Zoom today. We are recording this session, but only an audio recording will be available later on our website. Council, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and Council for Appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. At the start of your arguments, if each of you could please state your name and the party you represent for the record, and if there are any particular ways in which you wish for us to refer to you or your client, please let us know. We are ready for counsel for appellant. You can begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would ask for 5 minutes for rebuttal.
You will have that automatically, 15 and then five. Okay. Go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Dane DeCray, and I represent Zachary Harding in this matter. The first issue I'd like to discuss is the district court's incorrect fruit of the poisonous tree analysis. The district court properly held that the cell phone was illegally seized from Zach's home, but it did a poor job in doing its fruit of the poisonous tree analysis. This is a four-factor test, and there'll be two factors that I'm focusing on. First, and most importantly, is the likelihood that the evidence obtained would have been obtained absent the illegality. And as we noted in our brief on page 26 of our opening brief, we think this is a classic example of a but-for test. But for the illegal seizure of Zach's phone, Zach would not make the jail calls that he made. Now, in the state's response brief, they say that this was not in the record. The idea that Zach was not on notice or didn't know that his phone had been seized at the time he made the incriminating jail calls. That is incorrect. In both Judge Lawson's omnibus order and the transcript from the omnibus hearing, it is clear that Zach knew that his phone had been taken when he made the calls. On page 3 of the omnibus order, lines 3 through 5, this is what Judge Lawson writes. Of interest to Detective Schultz in the jail phone calls was that defendant expressed concern for the phone that was found in the residence and repeatedly asked the victim to find the SD card for the phone to hide it. How could Zach express concern for a phone found in his residence if he wasn't on notice that the police had found the phone? He was on notice. Further,
was there a problem with the police finding the phone and saying, "We found your phone"?
To tell my client that, or the fact
that the district court concluded that the seizure of the phone was problematic and unlawful. Was there, from your perspective, a problem, a constitutional problem or otherwise, with the police finding the phone and conveying that information to your client, separate and apart from any seizure?
There's a problem with them seizing the phone. There's no constitutional problem with them telling my client that they've done so. I think you could impute some bad faith on the police as a way to set a dragnet, hoping my client would go to jail and make calls about it. But they have the right to tell him, "We seized your phone," and tell him those things. However, the issue
did the record, may I just like be more specific to, on the finding the phone, did the record reveal that the police not tell your client that they found the phone, not that they seized it, that they found it? What does the record tell us about that? In other words, when they encountered the phone at the house, did they say, hey, whose phone is this? I have this phone, et cetera.
I don't believe my client was in the room when they found the phone. I believe he was in a different room while the search was being conducted. I do think in the state's argument, they say that he disclaimed that. I'm not sure that's in the record as I read the transcript, but the district court ultimately found that this phone belonged to my client and that it was illegally seized. And I think that's the important thing to focus on here is what happens after that illegal seizure. As I was saying before, that goes back to the but-for causation. There's simply no reason to believe that my client would make incriminating phone calls about a phone that he didn't know had been seized. And but for those jail calls that he made, the police would have been unable to get a second warrant. And without a second warrant, the police would not have found the SD card that ultimately had the incriminating information. This is much like State versus Leonard, which we cite in our brief on page 26 and 27. Zach's jail calls were, quote, simply the logical result, not interruptions, of the illegal search of his phone. This factor should be dispositive in the fruit of the poisonous tree analysis. The other factor we think that the court got wrong was the flagrancy of the misconduct. There's no debate, at least from the district court, that Zach's phone was illegally seized. But then in its analysis, it says that the illegality was not flagrant. That's incorrect because it doesn't do overall justice to exactly what happened here. The district court frames it as the good faith mistakes of officers getting information from a probation agent who maybe didn't know exactly what's going on. The flagrancy is earlier and more permeating throughout the record in this case. It begins with an allegation that a man at a residence had a gun. The police figure out that the resident is my client. They realize he's on state probation. They call his probation officer and they learn why he's on probation. Child pornography convictions from another state. The wheels begin turning. They then use those convictions to get a warrant to search him for guns and his home. They're wrong about the warrant. His convictions don't disqualify him for owning a gun. But okay, fine, we'll let it slide. They execute the gun warrant at the residence. Remember, the warrant is for guns, not child pornography. But they use it to find a phone. The phone is not a gun, but it was in a drawer, and it had to be moved and taken out to make sure there wasn't a gun under it. They didn't do this with the clothes that was in the drawer, but okay, fine, we'll let it slide. Not only do they find the phone.
Well, I have to get back to my question. I mean, are you arguing that it was improper for them to remove the phone from the drawer during the course of the search?
Of course we are.
So they should have done what instead of removing the phone?
They should have done the same thing they did with the clothing and other things that the human hand and the human brain would automatically know was not a gun and was outside the scope of the warrant. If they thought they had to open that drawer and take everything out to make sure there wasn't guns, ammunition, anything related to it, they would have taken out the whole drawer. They left the clothes in because clearly they had no interest in the clothes. They would have felt the phone in real time. A reasonable officer would have realized this isn't a gun. This is not part of the warrant. I have no right to touch this. And they would have moved on. The district court disagrees with us in that point. That's why we're arguing it here. But had they taken everything out and looked through everything or put it on the bed, they may have a better argument and a better leg to stand on. That they treated the phone differently than clothing when neither are anywhere close to the feeling of a gun shows that that original immediate seizure was illegal. So when they seized the phone, they don't have the authority to do so. It's not part of the warrant, and they haven't yet talked to his probation officer. Not only do they seize it, they take it out of the drawer and they begin to manipulate it. There's much to do about this.
But the simple fact is, the phone illuminates somehow, and there's somehow a way to find out that there's no SD card. There's no testimony to how it illuminates. There's no testimony to where the officer looked for the missing SD card. It's just, it happened, and therefore it must be true. This seems sketchy, but okay, fine. Let's let it slide.
They then call his probation officer to get permission to seize a phone they've already seized. They know they don't have authority under the warrant, so they need it from somewhere else, the probation officer. The probation officer says, go ahead, seize the phone. Zach signed a search clause, except that he didn't, which is why the probation officer knew that when he did, and that's why he gave permission despite that. They later then get some phone calls, they get wind of phone calls that Zach was talking about the SD card missing from the phone, and they got use that to get a second warrant. They find the SD card, and lo and behold, they find the child pornography that this case was about the entire time. And after they find the child pornography, the state dismisses the gun charge against Zach, which, remember, was the only reason the state got the warrant to get inside the house in the first place. At some point, only so many coin flips can land government side up before it's no longer a coincidence. That's what's at issue here. The gun warrant was flagrantly a Trojan horse for what the police wanted all along, which was to check to see if Zach was looking at child pornography again. Unfortunately, they were right. But the ends can never justify the means. This court cannot endorse this sort of backdoor warrant conduct. And without suppression, Zach will be left with no remedy for a violation of his Fourth Amendment rights. This too, the court cannot endorse.
When we look at the factor that involves the officer's misconduct, whether it was flagrant and whether or not the detective or officer believed that it was for a legitimate purpose, is there some evaluation of credibility in there? It seems like you're arguing that various of these actors, including the probation agent and the detective, were dishonest about their motives throughout this process, and that the point I'm trying to get to is, shouldn't we be deferring to the district court's determinations on credibility and what it found with regard to the intentions and so on and so forth?
So I do believe that the pretext of the officers or the probation agent is a factor in the flagrancy of the violation. I don't have that case fight in front of me. I'm happy to provide it to the court after today's argument. But I think your question is also getting to the standard for factual findings versus legal determination. Here, I find that to be a chicken egg problem, because the legal determination here is that the fruit of the poisonous tree was purged. And in order to make that legal conclusion, which you reviewed de novo, you have to make factual findings, which you review clearly erroneous. And so I will concede that it's not exactly clear how you make that determination. Our position is, even if it's under the clearly erroneous standard, the fact that the district court only found that these officers were making a good faith belief on a probation officer doesn't fully consider the breadth of the record that I just outlined. And so I believe under either a de novo review, which we prefer, or a clearly erroneous standard, the flagrancy factor is still incorrect. I'd also now like to talk about the sentencing in this case. I see I only have 3 minutes, so I may have to talk about this a bit more on my rebuttal. But this issue is relatively straightforward, and we simply believe that the state failed to prove up my client's prior convictions from Virginia. And because the state failed to do so, those convictions cannot count towards the misdemeanor units and points that the district court gave them credence. There's two ways that this is proved. Number one is that the state never proved there were multiple victims in his Virginia convictions. Second, the state didn't prove it was not a single behavioral incident. Now, in the state's response brief in the appellate court, it references Zach's Virginia judgment, and it has a single paragraph that discusses that. The problem with that is that Virginia judgment is nowhere in the record at the district court. Nothing in the record establishes that this was ever offered. It wasn't offered at the omnibus hearing. It wasn't offered at the sentencing hearing. It wasn't offered in any briefs related to the party's fight on this. And so the simple fact is, without that judgment, there are no facts establishing
the two things that must be established to use these convictions the way the district court did. The only thing that that the state has that they argued was in a response to an objection to the qualification of these convictions that was made on January 24th, 2023 by trial counsel. 2 days later, the state responded on January 26th in a 3-page memo. It's in the record. And they wrote simply, the defendant has 31 gross misdemeanors, which is more than enough units to equal one criminal history point. That is the very same you should assume language that this court rejected from this prosecutor in Roland. There is nothing in this record that establishes that my client's Virginia convictions did not involve a single victim or were not a single behavioral incident. It is not this court's job to fix that error. It was not the district court job to accept it. If the state wanted these convictions to count, it was their job to prove it up. They did not do so in any document that is in this record. They did not make that argument at the sentencing hearing. And the judgment, the Virginia judgment that the state references in its appellate brief, was only first introduced at the appellate level. That means the district court never had it. It never considered it. And so these convictions were never proved up.
So
that sentence was illegal.
So the exhibit, the sentencing order from the Virginia cases, that's not in the district court record? Or you don't think it matters?
Even if it's there, we have an argument as to why we still think that the way the state argued it on appeal is incorrect. But our review, which lasted late into the evening last night, is that nowhere this was put in the record. I know on MICRO, there is no filing for this. It's a 7-page order. You can search MICRO right now. There's no 7-page order on the docket. And it was not offered as an exhibit at the omnibus hearing. And so this Virginia judgment is not in the record for this court.
Okay, we'll come back to you on rebuttal probably with some questions about that. We'll turn to counsel. Thank you, counsel. Turn to counsel for respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Pamela Foss, and I represent the state of Minnesota and the respondent in this matter. And I'll apologize. I'm getting over a cold, so if I start coughing, I will apologize. But I was just looking in the record. Mr. DeCray was not the attorney of record at the district court. I was. I distinctly remember that the Virginia convictions were entered as part of the contested hearing. I just don't have access to the Mindy system right now to look it up. So I do disagree with that. But I want to go back to his original argument regarding the fruit of the poisonous tree analysis by the trial court. I would agree with Judge Wheelock that we have to give deference to the district court and their determination of some credibility of what was occurring at that hearing and the officer's credibility, as well as the probation officer's credibility that testified. First issue, the likelihood of the absence of the illegality or the but-for test, as Mr. DeGray outlines, that there's a lot of assumptions that he is making that but-for this and that would have happened. He's putting a lot of an argument on the bad faith of the police department and how their end game was a child pornography investigation. That was never fleshed out. That was never determined. That was never even an issue that was raised. I mean, it's obvious from the initial warrant they were searching for guns that stemmed out of a domestic investigation where a domestic victim told officers she was afraid of the defendant because he had a gun and they lived together in this home. That's why they went into the...
Can I ask if I recall correctly? I mean, part of the... I understand appellant's argument has to do with the manner in which a gun was handled, manipulated, et cetera. That officer, I think, did not testify at the hearing. Is that correct? And so how does credibility determination, what is there to defer to if that officer was not testifying?
Well, and you said gun, but I think you meant phone, correct?
My apologies. Yes. Thank you.
So the officer that initially located the phone during the search did not testify. The investigator that wrote the warrants and furthered the investigation did testify. That's the credibility determination as to what Mr. DeCray's argument about how this was just some sort of conspiracy to get at child pornography. It's very interesting that you point out, and I was going to point out, that that officer did not testify, because Mr. DeCray makes a whole argument how it was moved and how it was manipulated and taken out of the drawer. The record doesn't reflect that. The record reflects that the phone became an issue when they were searching through the drawer, the initial officer that didn't testify saw it was in the drawer, moved it aside while he was looking for the gun. He told the investigating officer that he saw that phone. One of the things that was brought in was that this victim needed a phone and they were looking for a phone for her. So Detective Wiedemeyer then asked the defendant, there's a phone in the bedroom. Is it yours or is it the victim's? Because they were trying to get a phone back to the victim. That's when the defendant became aware that a phone had been located in the drawer. The investigation continued with then a call to a probation agent who believed that he had the ability to search that, told the officer or the investigator that, who's testified he'd done that several times at the request of probation officer. So at the request of that probation officer, he seized the phone. But there was no testimony regarding taking it out of the drawer or moving it. I would submit that the officer that did find it did nothing wrong by taking it and moving it out of the drawer
just interrupt you there, because I'm not sure that the record contains facts about what happened when the phone was removed. You know, how the officer came to observe that it was fully charged. And those types of pieces of evidence would be necessary, don't you think, in order to make a determination about whether the handling of the phone was lawful.
And I think what happened at the hearing was that the reliable hearsay of the officer, what he told the investigator, was admitted, and the investigator testified what he was told by the officer, which caused him then to act how he did. So I believe it was brought in through an exception of hearsay, and that's why we didn't call the original officer. But there is, you're correct, there is nothing from that officer exactly what he did other than what he told the investigator, which then caused him to act how he did, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so if we assume that the handling of the phone, you know, amounted to an improper search, whether it was pushing a button to, you know, see whether it was fully charged or see what the officer could see, if we believe, and I certainly don't want to speak for my panel mates, but if that was improper, must the SD card be suppressed, or is the propriety of the handling of the phone necessary for us? Do we have to agree with the district court in order for you to prevail here?
I don't think so, because the phone was ultimately suppressed by the court. Which is an interesting argument that Mr. DeCray is making, that they didn't suppress it soon enough. But I think the fact that the officer saw a phone, whether that was illegal seizure, I don't think that then is the fruit of the poisonous tree for the SD card, because the phone, which was ultimately searched by the consent of this respondent or this appellant, had nothing on it. There was no reason for him to be concerned that they seized that phone, because there was nothing on it. But he's arrested. There's nothing on the phone that was suppressed. The SD card is what the issue was that came up later through additional information provided by the domestic violence victim, who alerted the police that she had talked to him while he was in custody, and he was wanting her to go back to the residence and hide further evidence.
But the, okay, the argument is that the officer, they knew there was no SD card, and they knew that because they improperly handled the phone, which was outside of the scope of the warrant. So, you know, but for that unlawful handling of the phone, which enabled them to discover that it didn't contain an SD card, they wouldn't be looking for an SD card. And the appellant wouldn't have made statements about the SD card. So the handling of the phone is, you know, something that I think is before us in this appeal. And I'm just wondering if you can help me understand why it doesn't really matter, which I think is your position.
Yes, I don't think there was such a time gap in between the search warrant and the location of the SD card and so much other information that came forward that I don't think it matters whether or not they picked up a phone and saw it, looked at it and saw that it didn't have an SD card as they moved it. I don't think it should be suppressed. I don't think that was an illegal handling. And even if it was, we're making a lot of assumptions of how this defendant would have acted. He wouldn't have made the phone calls. I don't know if that's true or not. There's nothing in the evidence that says he wouldn't have made those phone calls.
Yeah, but whose burden is it here? I mean, it's not his burden, right?
Right, but I'm with the record as it reflected, there is nothing, this idea that's being argued, the court district was argued at the district court, and the district court weighed the credibility and the testimony and found against the defendants. So I think a lot of it is on the credibility of the people that testified and the evidence that was presented to the district court, who believed there was enough separation between simply moving a phone as you looked for a gun to when they actually got the search warrant and executed that and found an SD card.
Going back to something I think Judge Smith asked opposing counsel, are you able to point us to anything in the record that establishes clearly whether appellant knew only that the phone had been located versus that it had been seized at the point in time when he made those phone calls from jail?
My recollection of the testimony was that he had already been transported to the jail before they actually seized it. He had been asked about the phone and whether or not it was his, but he was placed under arrest when the firearm was found and transported to the jail. So I don't believe he realized that they had seized the phone until he was already in custody. And then he received the return of property that went along with the search warrants, was put into his private or his property at the jail. And that's when he learned that they had taken the phone.
And that was entered into evidence through the testimony of Detective Wiedenmeyer?
Yeah, that would have been through the exhibit that contained this application for the search warrant, and I believe the property inventory was also submitted.
Thank you.
Mr. Ducre also argues about the flagrancy of the misconduct, which I think we've kind of addressed, that the testimony of the officer that first saw the phone wasn't in the record. But again, you need to weigh the credibility of Detective Wiedenmeyer. I don't believe anything was shown that there was any improper motive other than they were doing a domestic violence investigation and they came across a phone. They were told by a probation agent that they could take the phone. They searched the phone and nothing was on it. It was the domestic violence victim that came back to them and said, there's another issue here, which then started a new investigation, which resulted in the second warrant being issued. Regarding the sentencing, again, like I noted at the beginning of my argument, I disagree that the Virginia convictions were not entered. I believe it was actually through defense counsel calling Mr. Burse, who was the DOC agent, and putting in his I think, printout exactly of what the convictions were that it was also entered. But the testimony was that there were 31 convictions, and the court was well aware and had a copy of the convictions, had a copy that there were 31, it was told to the court, there was 31 separate court files. So it's not that we have one file that is 31 counts. We have 31 separate individual court files in Virginia that received individual sentences consecutive to one another in a time space between of 60 days.
So counsel, I think your position is that the state then established that these were, or am I wrong, that they did not arise out of a single behavioral incident. Is that correct?
Correct.
And that would, if they're out of multiple, if they're independent behavioral incidents, separate behavioral incidents, then you would say they should all be counted, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what is it that tells us when I look at the sentencing order, which I think is the exhibit that was admitted, unless I'm mistaken, at the district court? They all had the same offense dates of 3-1 to 4-30 of 2012, with the exception of one that had an overlapping offense date of 3-1, 2012. What tells us that those are separate? How did the state prove that these are separate behavioral incidents?
That they were separate court files, that it's a date range. It's not one day. It wasn't found on one day. It was a date range of 60 days. And that they all
could have been found, I suppose, on March 1 and satisfied that range and the one individual one, right?
They could have been. Then you would think that they would be in the same complaint. And I think if the court, and it's this wasn't raised and wasn't, I guess, an issue until we're sitting at the sentencing. Otherwise, the state would have provided the Virginia information. So if the court is to find that we didn't prove that up, we weren't given the opportunity, I think the appropriate remedy then is to remand it to the district court. So,
but you were given the opportunity at the sentencing hearing, right? I mean, you're not saying they didn't raise the issue at sentencing.
They briefly raised it at the sentencing hearing after, but the state wasn't put on notice. And I guess we didn't believe it was going to be an issue, so we didn't get those documents from Virginia. And it was the idea that they were separate court files, they're separate convictions, they're consecutive convictions, they're separate incidents.
You did have the opportunity at sentencing, though, to say, you know, we'd like the chance to prove this up by requesting the documents from Virginia, asking for a continuance. I mean, you weren't completely blindsided in the way, you know, I mean, this wasn't any different than any other sentencing hearing where there's a 60935 challenge made, right?
Right. But I remember, and I don't have the transcript pulled up here, the court didn't even look to the state to ask about that. The court just ruled and moved on. So after the court ruled, I guess I didn't feel the need to say, can I have a continuance to prove this up, because the court had ruled on it.
Judge Smith, may I ask a question?
Oh, yeah. Yes, please.
Would you agree, Ms. Foss, that the state has the burden, though, at the sentencing hearing to establish the facts necessary to show that there were these separate acts, separate incidents, separate victims, et cetera?
Yes, the state does have that burden.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. For rebuttal, there are 5 minutes for counsel for appellant.
There's lots of things to respond to, so I'm going to do as much as I can. First, I encourage the court to go look at the record in this case. The Virginia judgment is not in that record. It was not offered at the omnibus hearing. It was not offered later on. That is not in the record. The state is incorrect. And if the state is correct, I encourage them to find that in the record and submit an addition after this hearing. Next, the state talks about how we need to look to the credibility of the people that testified at the hearing. But as Judge Gaetas mentioned, the officer who manipulated the phone did not testify. It is not our burden to disprove that. It is their burden to prove that what he did didn't violate the Fourth Amendment.
he did not testify. They failed their burden.
Our response is speculation in so much as it's common sense. It's how we all use our cell phones. But the fact remains, the officer did not testify about that seizure. It is their burden. It was a violation of the Fourth Amendment.
Mr. DeCray, would you agree, though, that if we were to determine using the four factors under the fruit of the poisonous tree that the SD card was, in fact, not the fruit of an illegal search or seizure, that we don't really need to address exactly when the phone seizure occurred?
No, Your Honor. That's why I bring this up. I think the state tells me that we were mad that it wasn't suppressed soon enough. And I think this goes to Judge Gaetis's question. If we find that it was seized right away, then we never see the SD card. And therefore, it makes it even stronger for our fruit of the poisonous tree. Our fruit of the poisonous tree argument is at its zenith
if the seizure occurs immediately, but it still wins if it occurs when the judge at the district court said it occurred here. Finally, the but-for test here, it would be to deny reality if we think that my client would have got on a phone to talk about an incriminating SD card if he didn't think the police had that phone with a missing SD card. And I'll say the quiet part out loud. My client likely knew that there was bad stuff on that SD card. And so he was calling on that phone to say, hey, they've taken my phone. They've taken the phone without an SD card. You need to go find that SD card and get rid of it. If he didn't think they had knowledge of the phone or they were on his scent for the SD card, he would have shut his mouth and not made those calls. That may not paint him in the greatest light before this court, but it is exactly true. It is human nature. It is but for causation. Without them seizing the phone and telling him, and Judge Wheelock, you asked about that at the omnibus hearing. Here is what Judge Lawson said when they were determining exactly what we were challenging. She said, so your challenge is that the calls from the jail were triggered by the conduct at Zach's home and they need to be suppressed. Trial counsel says, yes, Your Honor. That should dispel any further question as to whether or not my client knew when he made those jail calls. Now let's move to sentencing. Let's assume, which is untrue, this Virginia judgment was not in the record, but let's assume it is. Judge Smith's analysis is still right. First, there's nothing in that judgment about multiple victims, nothing. Second, it offers the same offense date. It's just a range instead of a specific date. It doesn't establish that there's actually different dates. It requires the court to assume that. This court told this prosecutor in Roland, it's not going to assume. And yet this prosecutor is back asking for the same assumption. Here is how we know that this Virginia judgment was not in the record. At the omnibus hearing in the micro, April 21st, 2022, the judgment was not offered as an exhibit. Ms. Foss says that it was. The trial counsel is my law partner, Bruce Ringstrom Strenier. I talked to him last night at 10:30 at night. He did not offer this into evidence. Then the PSI, which was filed on December 5th, 2022, listed the Virginia convictions, but all on the same date. The only thing in the record that mentions the convictions, all on the same date, 3/1/2012. 2 days before sentencing, trial counsel objects to the sentencing worksheet, finding that there's a misdemeanor point. He specifically objects to the Virginia convictions counting as too many units. 2 days later, Your Honor, may I finish this?
Go ahead.
2 days later, the state responds. This is where Ms. Foss is incorrect. The state had a chance the day before sentencing to write a memo in response. We put her on notice. We don't think these Virginia convictions count. She responded 2 days later. It's in the record. January 26th. She doesn't put the judgment in. She doesn't reference the judgment. She simply says, as I mentioned before, the defendant has 31 gross misdemeanors, which is more than enough to count as one criminal history point. That
okay,
is not.
If you could wrap up.
And then finally, I'm sorry, at the sentencing hearing, Judge Gaetis and Judge Wheelock are correct. We started off by arguing that Virginia convictions didn't count. The trial counsel listened. They turned to Ms. Foss and said, "Do you have a response?" And she said, "We have no response other than what we already filed." That is what the record is.
Okay. Great. Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments today and your briefing. We appreciate it. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in the statutory time period.